The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Unpost. MyBills.ie. Help save time with bill payment online for free. Unpost. Do more.
And thank you very much indeed for that. Now, calls in about Keith Duffy. Well done, Keith. You deserve all the good things you get. You were always so kind, even at the height of your fame when my daughter met you. Another caller says, when she was 16, my granddaughter won backstage passes at a Childline concert where Boyzone were singing. She was thrilled. She's now 23 and still remembers how lovely Keith Duffy was to them. He made time for her, and you don't forget that. And that's the truth. You don't. So well done on that. Now, it's time for a competition. And to celebrate St. Patrick's Day and the bank holiday weekend, we're giving you the chance to win a bumper prize. Two tickets to the National Theatre's award-winning production of War Horse, which is coming to the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre from the 26th of March to the 26th of April. So they're the tickets. And also an overnight stay for two, plus breakfast in the Marker Hotel. Now, listen, you couldn't find a better location than that if you were going to the theatre. And to win, you must answer this question. War Horse is set during which war? And you text your answer to 51551. And my thanks to the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre and the Marker Hotel for those lovely prizes. And we will have a winner by the end of the show. Now, another show that's looking for a winner is on at the moment on your screens during the week, and it is MasterChef. It's back on, excuse me, with Dylan McGrath and Nick Mounier judging the would-be chefs. And Dylan McGrath is joining me now. I was just saying to you there before, during the break, it said in the paper this morning that normally the Taoiseach gives the American president a bowl of shamrock, right? Apparently this morning or yesterday or whatever time of day we're talking about, he gave him a bowl of shamrock and a basket of Irish food. What would you put into a basket of Irish food?
A hamper. An Irish hamper, was it?
Yeah. Effectively. I presume.
We do some fantastic produce. There is things that we do, in my opinion, that we do better than a lot of other countries, or especially European counterparts. But probably raw produce I would be a lot more a fan of. I'm not sure you could give it away in a hamper. But lamb, beef, those are the things that we do really well.
Right.
There's been a huge upturn in farm or growers. I think it's the recession has really brought it on, and there's so much information out there about trying to buy
local
home produce. So anything that would encourage for us to use our own, I think is fantastic. But definitely raspberries, don't you think, or strawberries?
Yeah, sure.
We do them, or gooseberries. You remember them?
Is it the right time of the year? I wonder.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of the things that the competitors were asked to do on MasterChef is to create a traditional Irish dish. What does a traditional Irish dish mean, apart from Irish stew?
Well, you see, I have it's difficult. It's a very difficult one because, you know, I think that Irish food in the last couple of years has really sort of rocketed in terms of, you know, Irish cooks being incredibly creative But I think before that, there was a real sort of stagnant period where it was Colcana, champ, ham and parsley sauce. And we were very restricted as to what we could call our own.
Yeah.
I think that the amount of Irish cooks cooking today that are being incredibly creative with the produce that we have, and the recession has brought that on, is completely different. But for a long time, we were very, very stagnant. Because even as a young cook, you try to... I think a lot of food is based on nostalgia. So when you say try to modernise an Irish stew or bring it up to date, it's something that a challenge that we faced in the restaurant where I said, I want to do Irish stew. If we're going to create a concept that is Irish,
yeah,
I want to cook something like Irish stew, but bring it up to date. But there isn't many dishes like that. And I mean, people forget that, I think, what is
How
it,
do you bring 1845 Irish stew up to
1849,
date?
The country died of starvation. So
yeah.
I think that hugely affected us and how we regard food. And we're not like the Spanish or the French in terms of climate. So therefore, how do you bring it up to date, you're saying?
Yeah.
Well, you take something that's as classical as, Irish stew, and you think, okay, knowing what we know today about food, about texture, about flavour, about joining flavour, can we elevate the dish? And you know, one of the things that I do is simply take a lamb fillet that we have loads left from prepping out from the racks, and just simply panning that in flour, egg wash, and breadcrumb, and then we use all of the components of, like, you know, those celery lovage flavours. So we do a braised piece of lamb, loads of onion in it, and loads of, because effectively Irish stew is potato. It gets its texture from the potato broken down as like a casserole.
Go ahead.
So once you take it to that, then what we did was we panned the fillet, and just put balsamic vinegar on that after it's deep fried, and carved that, and that adds a crunchy texture into it, but it still keeps it very lamby. So yeah, that works really
well. Right. You talked about the recession, and I presume it was the recession what done for you in your first restaurant, your Michelin restaurant.
Yeah.
Do people just stop coming, or did they just not want to spend that much money?
Yeah, I mean, from I can only speak firsthand from my experience and my reality, and that was, yeah, that effectively, it's not that they stopped coming, but people were, you know, the customers that were there, there was a deep-rooted fear when the banks closed that, you know, they didn't know where things were going next. And I seen it, you know, I seen it affect, there was a drop in spend of maybe 4 or 5 grand a night, you know, so that's huge. And it's not, yes, they come less, but when they also come, they spend less.
Right.
And I mean, we all remember all of the deals, all of the Michelin star restaurants, but when you've got 100 covers, you can take more. The problem with mine was it was so small. So it really, there was no trading out of it. There was no bar to put people in and to, you know, to obviously rotate customers and do two or three sittings, or, there, you know, on a Friday night, there wasn't 100 chairs to put 100 people. There just wasn't. So because my whole point was, it was so precise that, you know, the spend was so much higher. What it cost you in mint was dearer. But you needed to do the volume, or you needed to do the correct amount of covers, and you needed them to spend. So once the spend went, I mean, the business dropped off rapidly.
Right. And how long did it take you then to reinvent yourself, so to speak? Because you loved that kind of food and that kind of preparation of food.
Yeah, well, I'd spent 10 years, you know, addicted to that sort of work. And I was talking to Daniel Clifford a little while ago in Midsummer House. He came over and we were speaking. He's a 2-star in Cambridge. Really talented, but very down-to-earth cook. But really talented guy. And, you know, we were talking about, you know, that if you really want to be a good cook, you know, you nearly need to give it those 10 years. And I'd done that. And that was where I was at. And that was what I understood. So I didn't really understand anything else. So I think it took me a good year and a half to really sort of go, okay, what can we do? And I, you know, thought about it because I had to, what we could do. And then you slowly find your way, you know, once you've accepted that that's not a reality anymore and I can't cook like that presently, what else can I do? And how do I make it the complete opposite of what I've just done so that people don't think that it's a weaker version of that?
Right.
How do I, you know, create concepts that really have a philosophy or a backbone, or have something that is purposely designed to have a completely different angle on things. And the first thing we did was Rustic Stone,
right,
which is really about giving people the healthy option to go that way if they want. And I mean, the way people responded to that was...
It's a lot of raw food there, which is put together in a very interesting way. And I mean, the business is doing brilliantly. But it seems extraordinary the banks weren't lending. I mean... Was it a tough time to say, listen, we're going to give this a go?
It was the toughest. I can't think of a tougher time. You need to have courage. You need to have
money though.
Yeah, but you need to have the right people with you as well, you know. And everybody across the board was experiencing that. Everywhere I went, it was tough on a lot of people. I mean, you know, you've seen it yourself and spoken to so many people over the last, you know, couple of years, just exactly how it sit. But for me, I just watch things very closely, and you know, I've got a great business partner with me. But when I was looking at it, I was sort of going, you know, I noticed that the crowd shifted. That, without speaking ill of any other restaurant, but the crowds moved to other restaurants, and it was because of price point. Other restaurants were busy now. They didn't hold on to the customers quite as long as they should have, but they certainly got a chance. And I could see people going there because of the price points and because of And I thought, right, okay, can we create a diffusion brand that isn't, you know, sort of like a cheap mint? I don't want to do that. Fine dining and that sort of level of expertise is that level of expertise. But can we create something? And my mum was very sick as well. So that really, you know, focused me on trying to stay here and, you know, be with her as well as try and create a new concept that would work. But you don't know for sure whether it's going to work, man. You know, you really don't.
Right.
But it did. So.
It did. In fact, I wonder, this is a question, not a statement. If you take how busy George's Street is now, for those, people outside of Dublin would be aware of Dawson Street and Grafton Street. But George's Street is kind of roaring at the moment. I mean, did everything move there because the rents were cheaper?
That's exactly why, I think. You know, I mean, it seemed like the other end of the city. That's what it seemed like to me, like as if it was taking too long for everybody to become realistic, because effectively they wanted their rent, you know, they needed their rent. So it was just a case of, do you remember that big case where, I think it was Carluccio's, where it was like,
that's right,
you know, it was a real push and pull scenario as to whether or not they were going to give in or not. And it seemed like that side of the city was just unrealistic. And you know, at the end of the day, rent is a huge part of making a restaurant work, and your bills are your bills and the percentage to what you take. So when it came to customer spend dropping and people being a lot more, I mean, I remember having a conversation with a fishman where he said, you know, if you can't do dinner for two in Dublin for €110 today, you're at nothing. You know, there wasn't. So there was that time. And you know, for me, that side of the city was a lot more realistic. And from what we can see, there's a huge amount of innovation springing up everywhere on that side of the city. Concepts happening everywhere because, you know, it's great because it's created a real dining hub there, hasn't it?
Absolutely. Now, you've added to that yourself with your second restaurant there, which is Fades Research. I gather Beyonce was in there. Was it Beyonce was in there?
Yes, she was, her and Jay-Z. Very nice.
Did it cause a bit of a stir?
No, they were really polite. I only spoke to them very briefly, but they were incredibly polite and just really well mannered. They were in there on their own. They're probably the type of people that just, you know, God, can you imagine what it's like to be them? So they're just looking for privacy. So they were kind of in their corner.
Right.
But they were, they really loved the food and they complimented it on it and they had a nice time and. Yeah, it was cool.
Great. Good for business, I would think, as well. Now, you're going to open a kitchen with no dining room.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, I'm working on a project at the minute that is about going another step further in terms of, you know, we're thinking about, I've always wanted to develop, once I've seen Rustic Stone working, I've always wanted to finish that as a concept. I want to do something else that's kind of about, I believe today that a lot of people are going out to restaurants, but a lot of people are doing the same cream, fat. There is a market for people who just genuinely want the choice to be maybe healthy or to pick healthy if they want. So once I defined that through Rustic Stone, I want to do another project now that is about, it's kind of like healthy eating, but it's also, it's a lot got to do with raw fish, which I love because I love sushi and stuff like that. So, and then I'm also doing a kitchen where we're just doing a development kitchen. So I'm just developing different, you see, I think that if you don't keep touching ingredients that you lose a relationship with them. And with all the work that I have on today, I don't want to lose that connection with food. So I want to have a productive area that I can work with my chefs on creativeness, because that's what a lot of us cooks are, very creative. So if I don't have a space that we can develop for the different concepts that I've created, then they'll become weak. And I don't want that. I want them to be always, I don't want you to come into Rustic Stone and eat the same thing today that we'd be cooking in 4 years' time. I want us to be doing stuff and I want to keep it fresh all the time. So when we have as many concepts of that, it's incredibly hard when you're doing 240 covers to walk into a kitchen and to just say, right, everybody stop what you're doing. We're going to do this thing today.
Yeah.
It doesn't work like that. So I need a space where I can work with the guys on being creative. And then as we say, right, that's a one-star Michelin dish, or that's for Rustic Stone, or that's for Fade Street Tapas Bar, or that's for the restaurant.
Right.
So we've got all these different things going on, and I just want to keep it fresh.
Did the skills that the competitors have on MasterChef
yes.
surprise you?
Their love of food surprises me. their commitment to it surprises me. Every now and again, they'll do something that is just, I don't know if it's a fluke or whether or not but sometimes it's just, it's really good and it's really brilliant. But I think their love and their relationship with food as normal people continually surprises me. And that's why we take it so, you know, at least I do. We try to really look for the winner and not make a mistake, because they seem to be incredibly, as much in love with food as any chef I've ever seen.
Yeah, I
but they do it in the comfort of their own home, you know what I mean? And
yeah, then that's a different thing.
Yeah, completely, completely. Mm. But their relationship with food is as strong and as committed as anything I've seen. But obviously they've raised families, or they've had jobs, or they've done all these different things in their life, and they're not professionals.
Yeah.
But their relationship with food is kind of...
I mean, would you expect that level, like if you wandered into somebody's house of a night? Like when you were growing up, what did your mother cook?
My mother... She done her best, but we weren't the most affluent family in the world. So, you know, there was a lot of things that I learned as a chef. I really had no repertoire of information about food. By the time I became a chef, I was the first time I ate a mushroom. It was the first time I ate a pepper. There was none of that, because I wouldn't have eaten that as a kid, because my mom would have probably boiled it, God bless her, for 2 hours. So I wouldn't have eaten that sort of stuff. And then when I became a chef, I learned how to cook cabbage, or I learned how to what foie gras tasted like, or what a piece of prawn tasted like for the first time. But amongst people who knew how to cook them. So my idea of food changed then, and my love of food changed. But when I was growing up, I've always said it, people have always asked me, you know, I wasn't picking broad beans with my granny or any of that sort of stuff, or my mum wasn't picking morels and frying them. There was none of that. Mm. So it came much later in life for me. But in West Belfast we were, so there was, you know, mandarin oranges and tins of creamed rice was about the height of it.
Right. I know that you were in Belfast, but you're not originally from Belfast, are you not?
No, my mum, I was born in Rotunda here in Dublin, and my mum, we lived on Gardiner Street, which I travelled down most days going to work, but we lived on Gardiner Street for about 2 years, and then we lived in, my granddad was actually a chef in the army in Kildare. So we were in Carlow for about till I was about 7 or 8, and then she married and we moved to Belfast.
Right. Mm. And how was that? I mean, your accent is still very Belfast. How was that as a youngster growing up? About what time are we talking about here?
How do you mean?
In terms of dates, was it during the Troubles?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. When we went to Armore Street, which was the Falls Road, which was right on Clonard, right up from the Royal Victoria Hospital. And I remember being explained, you know, where we were going to. And we lived in one of those little houses in Clonard with no inside toilet. So we had to go out the back to go to the toilet. But it was those kind of hardcore, you know, that, you know, those little ones with no garden. So we moved in there initially, and the Troubles were bang as high as they ever were, you know. I grew up during the Troubles, I suppose. So we had seen lots of different things that you guys didn't see down here. That's for sure.
Like what?
Oh, a number of different experiences. I'd seen a lot of injustices in terms of, you know, being treated a certain way, spoken to a certain way by police or soldiers. But, you know...
Did you see it?
They say it's like I've had this conversation before, and it's like, you know, Billy Connolly says in the tenement flats in Glasgow, you've nothing to compare it to. So you don't really think it's an injustice, or you don't really think that it's anything. It's not till you grow up. And a lot of my friends were all joyriders. You know, that was like a national sport when I was growing up. My mother would have held me very closely. She wouldn't let me near a stolen car, but... that was kind of common practice. There was no police, you know. There was no TV license people. There was no parking tickets. There was normal rules that happen in any society in West Belfast were just completely null and void. I mean, if you had a problem with, you know, say your husband was hitting his wife, and the police would receive a call like that, they wouldn't come out for fear of a sniper attack. So you didn't really have a society that was policed. I mean, that's the reality. That's very much.
Did I read somewhere that you witnessed somebody handing his son over to the IRA?
Hmm.
What was that?
Well, he was a joyrider, and the IRA said he was an incurable thief. The father decided that he tended to agree, and it was one of the most shocking things I'd ever seen.
And what happened?
Quite remarkable. Well, he handed him to the IRA, and I remember hearing him getting beaten. It was tough. It was a tough one, you know. It was a horrible experience to see as a kid that there was that kind of that was the law of the land, you know.
Right. Mm. It was a long journey you've travelled then, isn't it?
But it also made me very determined to get up and get out of it, you know. So in some respects, it motivated me to say, this is not my reality. This is not where I want to raise my family. This is not what I want for life. So cooking was the first thing, that the first sort of bus that came along. And I said, right, I'm getting on this and I'm off. So, that took me across to England. Well, once I worked everywhere here, I kind of went, right, I really need to... And the thing about cooking is that you realise that you need to give yourself 100% to it. It's one of these crafts that you can't go half-assed. You know, you really need to give yourself 100% if you want to be the best. That's kind of the way I looked at it, and that's what I wanted to do. So,
Well, it was a good bus for you.
Yeah, it was a tough enough one. But the alternative was West Belfast, so I thought, no, I'm going to stay on this.
Right, okay. Listen, Dylan McGrath, thank you very much. Are you going to tell me who wins MasterChef?
No, I'm not. No. Of course I'm not. I'll be shot.
Is it a he or a she?
I can't.
Okay.
I can't.
Okay.
Nice indeed. Try, though.
Okay, listen, thank you very, very God much indeed. You.
1850 715 150.